This talk was given by Bear Gokhan Bonabacher at Zen Mountain Monastery. Gokhan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
I was thinking, as I was working on this talk, seeing in myself a tendency want to kind of pin things down, wanting to see how practice will allow us to figure things out, figure our life out. I think I see this particularly when I'm giving a talk, because it feels like, well, I'm supposed to be explaining that. And I think particularly when I'm working with one of the early teachings of the Buddha, these early sutras that were recorded and have been passed down to us in a particular way. They kind of, sometimes I find, lend themselves to this sense that you can kind of like figure it out. There's a bit of a formula. There are these categories, these lists that help us to understand. And so I found this text. This is a stanza that I think is not actually the Buddha speaking. He's sharing this stanza, and there's some other teachers that share this same stanza. So I don't think this is actually his words, although he said this, using this what seemed to exist. And so I found this, and it looked like the perfect text, kind of a simple teaching, direct teaching. A way to talk about Zazen, a way to talk about our practice. And then as I worked with it, questions kept coming up for me. There is a way that practice is simple. I say this when I give instruction in Zazen. Let it be simple. Let your Zazen be simple. Don't make it complicated. But it's not about pinning it down. It's a way in which it's not about understanding it. Let it lead you into the mystery. We do see things more clearly, understand our mind, understand the workings of our mind, and things open up. The vastness of mind, of our mind. And so in looking with this passage, there are questions, right? What are the past and the future? How do they meet us here in our mind, in this moment where our life is? What is time? And as I was thinking about this passage and about past and future, I would have said that I spend more of my time in my mind, in the future. And then as I was working on the talk, there was more and more to say about the past and our relationship with the past, how the past affects right here, now. And so, for the most part, the future is going to wait for another talk, possibly. And I wanted to tell the story of this sutra because I found it to be it's kind of a charming story. And so one version of this, there are actually several versions of this sutra, but the one that I was working with tells a story of one of the Buddha's monastics. He has gone to some hot springs to ease his limbs, it says. And then he is standing, he's gotten out of the hot springs, and he's waiting for his limbs to dry before he goes back to his hut, I guess, or wherever he's going back to. And while he's standing there, drying off, a beautiful deity, gender not specified, sidles up to him and says, "Friend, do you know the stanza of A Single Excellent Night?" Sorry, he says, do you know the summary and the explanation of a single excellent night? And he says, no, I don't. Do you, friend? And the deity says, no, I don't either. And then the deity says, well, do you at least know the lines, the stanzas? And he says, no. He says, and he asks the deity, do you, friend? And the deity says, no, I don't either. And then the deity says, you should go to the Buddha and ask him about this stanza, because it's an important teaching. It belongs, the deity says, to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. And so the monastic goes to the Buddha and asks the Buddha. And by this point, there's some other monastics there with sort of in a group. I sort of picture them sitting around the Buddha. And the Buddha tells them the verse, recites the verse, and then the Buddha stands up and goes into his hut. And they're like, wait a minute, you didn't explain it. And so there's some conversation, well, who can we get to explain this to us? And they go off and find Mahakakana, who is one of the Buddha's senior disciples, and asks him, they ask him to explain this verse, and he does. And then at the end of his explanation, he says, well, this is just my understanding. You know, if you have any doubts, you should go back to the Buddha and ask the Buddha. And so they go back to the Buddha, and by this point, the Buddha's come back out of his hut, and they ask him, and they tell the whole, you know, each time they've gone to the Buddha, they told the Buddha a whole story. So the monastic first tells the whole story of meeting with the deity, and then they come back and they tell the whole story and kind of repeat what Mahakakana had explained to them. And the Buddha says, yes, I couldn't have said it better myself. And when I read the sutras, I want to like read behind and between the lines, and sort of there are these little bits that give a little sense of, well, what was it like to be a student of the Buddha, to sit in front of the Buddha and ask for the teaching, to come kind of bother the Buddha. I wonder about that. Like, they don't seem so worried about coming and bothering the Buddha with all these questions that they have. And he doesn't seem so bothered. And then how do these teachings reach us from so far away? How do we meet them, and how do they meet us, coming from a different culture, from such a different time? How do they land here? So the verse says, let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes. The past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. And I hear Daido Roshi saying, speaking about past and future, he used to do, this was one of the things that he used to say over and over again, introducing an introductory weekend, this is one of the things he would say over and over again, that the past has already happened. It doesn't exist anymore. The future hasn't happened. It doesn't exist. Pointing then to the fact that we spend so much time, so much of our time in the past and in the future, in our mind, in our thoughts. And so, in looking at the past, what is the past? Where is it? What is memory? What are we doing when we go to the past in our mind? When, as it says in the stanza, that we revive the past? So in his explanation, Mahakakana says, one's consciousness becomes bound up with desire and lust. They are thinking, my eye was thus in the past, and forms were thus. One delights in that. When one delights in that, one revives the past. And then he walks through the rest of the senses. And so we remember how we found pleasure in the past, and our consciousness becomes bound up in these memories. memories of pleasure. And in doing that, we revive the past in our mind. We bring it back to life, give it life again. And as we all know, we can enter that. We can be there in our mind. And it is significant, I think, that he breaks this down into the senses. This was one of the sort of questions that was in this for me. Pointing, I think, to the fact that all of our experience is simply these sensory experiences. There's a coming together of the eye and forms, the ear and sounds, the nose and odors, the tongue and flavors, the body, things that we can touch, the mind and mind objects. What is this simple, direct experience that he's pointing to? Because that's not usually how we experience a memory or any experience. Right? There's, with a memory in particular, there's stories, there's a whole like understanding, a whole experience around these sensory experiences, a conglomeration of all of our different senses. So we remember a really good meal, and its taste, and its smell, and it's who we were eating with, the conversation, the way the sun was hitting our back, the pleasure of wearing a new shirt that we really liked at the same time. And around that, there may be a story that we've created. There's meaning that we've created. And so, one thing that I think, one way that is helpful that he breaks this down for us, is that it creates a question. What are these memories that we revive? Can we have some nature into their, some insight into their nature? Having some insight into their nature, can we let, it can be easier to let them go, to not be so caught in them, to not be attached, to not attach. Recently, Shoan has been saying to me, it's just mental fabrication. And often this is about the future. She sees that I'm worrying about something, that in 30 seconds I've created a story and started to worry about it, something that's coming up. It's just mental fabrication. And it's like I'm ready to hear this because it's really helpful. Oh, and I just created that. Let me let it go. I don't need to do that. Right? It really helps cut through. That's true of the past also. It's just a mental fabrication when we revive the past. And so again, knowing this, having some insight into this can help us cut through. I thought it was interesting that in his explanation, Mahakakana only talks about pleasure. How about all the time that you spend lamenting decisions that you've made, regretting things that you've said, wishing you'd done something differently, wishing you hadn't made a mistake, screwed up. This is also reviving the past. How we carry these thoughts around and revive them, and revive them, and revive them. How much weight they can have. And so why do we revive moments from the past, memories from the past that are unpleasant? Is there pleasure in them? Is there desire there? What are we creating? I was remembering a short story that I read a few years ago about a kind of virtual reality video machine that would play your past. And the story was about a man and his daughter. And they purchased this new machine that was available and put it in their TV room, I guess. I pictured sort of a darkened room as just this machine. And how they started to get caught in this. He would go and watch his past and go, you could fast forward and rewind and, you know, find just those particular moments that you wanted to go back to. And so he would go back to the moments of falling in love with his ex-wife. Those particularly full moments, full of emotion. He'd rewind them and play them over and over again. And he'd go back to the moments where things were breaking apart, where his wife was leaving. Seeing the moments where he should have said something different, should have said something, should have not said something. Watching her walk away and going back to those moments over and over. And he and his daughter were sort of trying to keep this secret from each other that they were spending so much time going back into the past. Like there was a need to keep it secret, that there was something not quite right about what they were doing. And I don't remember sort of how things played out between him and his daughter, but towards the end of the story, he kind of just gives in. And he like goes and buys a bunch of food and just kind of moves into the room and goes back into the past. And so there's a way in which we don't need that machine, right? We have that machine. The stanza says, the past has been left behind. It doesn't exist anymore. But has it been left behind? I was remembering a time during Sesshin doing oryoki. So for those of you who don't know, oryoki is a formal meal that we do during some retreats. We do here, and there are some students serve as servers, and so they bring in big bowls of food and serve the rest of the Sangha. And this particular time, I think I was actually just filling in as to help oversee the serving. And so I was standing in back and sort of watching things and helping facilitate things. And one of the servers was standing at the threshold ready to enter, full bowl, and she dropped it. And of course, it fell upside down. There's salad dressing everywhere. And so we all scurry around, we get some fresh bowls, we redistribute the rest of the salad, and the servers go out, right, and serve the salad. It's fine, it's taken care of, it's passed, right? It doesn't exist anymore. And I remember standing back there and seeing that. It's like I had this little insight into that. It doesn't exist anymore, it's over. I don't need to talk about it at the end of the week. I don't need to think about it. It's gone. It's taken care of. Life is moving on. And I was watching life move on, right? People being served food, we were chanting, everything was fine. And I could see, watching this woman who had dropped the bowl, that it wasn't over, right? She was reliving it. She was reviving that. And so has the past been left behind? And I was thinking about my early, I think it really was my first year of sitting, of practice. I was living here, pretty much brand new to practice, to Zazen. I was young, and remembering how much of that time of sitting was just kind of reliving high school and college, and being embarrassed and regretting, and like sort of seeing through the fog that I had been in. Like I couldn't even see what had happened when I was in high school, and somehow in sitting I would like be able to see it, and then I could be embarrassed about it. And letting it go. And, you know, I didn't know this at the time. I was just, like, I didn't know what I was doing. But looking back and realizing these things came up and they kind of moved through me and I let them go. I didn't even know that I was carrying them around. And it wasn't just these particular memories, but it was like my, you know, myself in those times, my experience of myself in those times, kind of feeling that and letting that pass. Like that wasn't me anymore, that I could let that go. Could put that down. You know, my relationship with myself, I was like, okay, that part is, we can move on. And feeling the liberation of that. I didn't even know what I was carrying, but I could feel that it was, I could feel the not carrying it anymore. And so there is that. We can be liberated from the past. We can put things down. And in doing that, arrive more fully right here in our life right now. And so that fundamental, so important part of Zazen, of seeing and letting go. You have to see it to let it go, for the most part. Seeing and letting go, and knowing the difference between seeing and letting go and seeing and perpetuating, seeing and holding on. And so there is this letting go. I was talking to someone recently about, she was saying something about her parents, and I really related to that, you know, and how for so long I, like, there was this, like, caughtness, and that I got to a point where I was like, I'm done with that, right? I can let that go. And again, just the liberation of that. That there's still history, there's still a relationship, there's still baggage, but it's not like there's no weight to it. Like it's not caught in it. And so that's true, right? I know that in my own experience, that we can be liberated from the past, from what we're carrying around from the past. But that's not all of it, right? And so as I was working on this talk, there was a point where it's like, okay, that's what the teaching was, right? In this explanation. But the past isn't just the past. It's not just in the past. That's too simple. I can't just say live in the present. Right? Just be here. There is that, and it's not all of it. We could use the teachings there actually to kind of escape, to deny truth of our experience, truth of how our mind, life works. We could use it to not see. Because the past is also always with us, in us, in ways that we can see and in ways that we can't always see. I think there are things that will always be in us, whether we can see them or not, affecting our experience. This is our conditioning. This also is the Buddha's teaching. This also is a fundamental teaching. And so again, what are these things from the past that live in us? Things that we've learned, that we've been taught. What are our memories and our regrets and the traumas that we've suffered, that we carry in different ways? Where do they live? What effect do they have on us? What is our relationship with them? Right? It's like we're in relationship with these parts of ourselves. What is karma? Right? Where does that live? How do we carry that? So the past does have an effect on the future, on the present. Right? We can't deny that. The past is past, and it meets us right here, right where we are. The whole of our experience is right here. And so I've been thinking about this recently with history. That's the past. It's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. And it still lives in us, right? Our own particular history and our societal history, cultural history. There is just this present moment, and there is how the past affects it. Last month or so, I've done a couple of workshops on looking at racism and oppression, privilege. A number of us, some of the board members and monastics and seniors yesterday were in a workshop here. And the other workshop that I did in particular, we spent a whole day basically, and it's a day-long history lesson, in our history. Looking at, you know, we were looking at racism and oppression and privilege today, right, as we experience it today in our life, in my life. But that rests on the past, on views and ideas, events of the past. It's perpetuated. That's what we're perpetuating. And so as we study mind, this teaching is pointing us to, as we study mind, to look at the past. So we should study that. Study the past in us, in this present moment, in our mind. How does it land here? What are we perpetuating? And so in Mahakakana's explanation, he also says, how does one not revive the past? One's consciousness does not become bound up with desire and lust, with shame and regret. It doesn't become bound up with anything. Don't become attached. And so we need to know for ourselves, what is it to be attached? How does that feel in our body, mind, in our experience? And to know for ourselves, what is it to let go? To be liberated from attachment? What is it to perpetuate? And what is it to let go? To see and let go? And not to miss that step of seeing. Sometimes we have to kind of wait for something to come up in order to see it. Sometimes it feels like, you know, it's kind of just luck. Something comes up and you get to see it and then you get to work with it. And it's kind of mysterious how that comes up sometimes. And sometimes it comes from the outside, kind of gets stirred up for us, life stirs it up for us. And then we get to work with it. Get to see something about ourselves. We have to want to see. So getting a little glimpse, then sometimes we have to like, okay, that's what I need to like, I need to see that clearer. I need to look more at that. Because there are things that are hard to see, or that we don't want to see. In some cases that we can't see, but they still have an effect. I see that sometimes in how I'm, just like how I'm holding my body, realizing that I'm holding my body in a way that no longer sort of communicates what's true. It's like this is an old habit, but my body is still doing it. Or I'll see myself reacting in a particular way and see that's not true anymore. But it's like still happening, I'm still doing it. And we do that together too. It's like we have joint collective habits that we do together. Sometimes that we can see, sometimes that we don't want to see, we don't choose to see. Where is that? How is that? That we're just like in so much that it's hard to see. But that I help to hold that. We help to hold that. What is that mind, that depth of mind? It's my mind. What is my mind? And what is mind? So I was thinking about that. I had a little whiff. I have kind of always been drawn to the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is this huge sutra, you know, just like it's a volume. And it sort of calls to me, and I'll pick it up sometimes and read it, and it is kind of full of splendor and complication, not complication, but decoration, and you know, people walking in the sky and huge congregations of decorated beings and parasols and rainbows and jewels, and then more arrive. And I just kind of get, often I kind of just get lost, and it's like they're just pages of this description, and I like, but I'm drawn to it. And so I had, as I was out, like, there is this, that is this vastness, this vast interdependent interconnectedness. Nothing is fixed, everything is related. And it all meets right here. Right here, where you're sitting, where I'm sitting. Time and space come together. And this is where we have to act and make choices and reckon with our own mind, the way that we are part of this vast decoration, with our own karma. We have to make choices that have an effect, do actions, and think thoughts and say things that have an effect. And so, this for me was also part of don't try to pin things down. Don't think you understand. I don't understand. The stanza says, "Let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let them see each presently arisen state." So don't attach to the past. Don't attach to the future. Don't attach to your presently arising experience. Today, the effort must be made. Tomorrow, death may come. Who knows? One who dwells thus ardently has had a single excellent night. A single excellent night. Or really, from the stanza, it's a day and a night. A single day, a single excellent night. And so, that's all. We're landed right back here. It is simply an excellent day, an excellent night of practice, right? Of right here, of studying our mind in the mystery of this moment and in the presence of people and things and a world that needs taking care of.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.